Clapper's raising issues that most of us haven't really thought of before. And this idea, at least the piece of it that I took out of it, creating kosher literature and film, it opens up a whole new area that I didn't explore. So I have some thoughts. I put it down on paper, but this is an exploration because it's the first time. I never gave a shiur anything remotely like this. So I want to hear what you all have to say. So don't be shy. I'm going to begin with the following. I'm not even going to start with the Makaros yet. I want to just share with you an observation, and then I want to and we'll schmooze about it a little bit, and then I want to talk a little bit about the film, and then we'll go to the Makaros. Okay, so here's the following observation. Now, how many of you have ever seen the Birnbaum Sitter? You've seen the Birnbaum Sitter, right? That's a translation. When was that translation made? When was it printed? Anybody have any idea? 40s? Yeah, 40s, maybe 50s, right?
I think it doesn't have Israel yet. It's got to be pre-state, I think.
Okay, so it's pre-state. Okay. All right, here I want to call to your attention two things in the Birnbaum. One in the Birnbaum, and I think the other is in the Birnbaum also. You say we Ashkenazim say Pita Maktoras every Shabbos, right? And Spartan and Nusach Spartan say it every day. But anyway, you'll notice that one of the things we mentioned is a little indelicate. You'll pardon me for being indelicate, but that's just the nature of what we're talking about. Speak about Meraglai. You'll pardon me for urine, right? So Amy, you know, think about it. You don't bring in the base of Meraglai, even though it may help. In the preparation of the Ketoret, but you wouldn't bring it to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, interestingly, I haven't noticed...
1949,
there you have it. And for Meraglai, he translates everything except Meraglai. He just leaves it Meraglai. You know, apparently that would just be too... it would be too offensive to the sensibilities of people in 1949 to write Meraglai. Now, I think it was in the Birnbaum, or it may have been Hertz. In Birnbaum, for the Yom Kippur, from Mincha, when they have about the Kriyas HaTorah, about the various arayos, when it came to homosexuality, it omits the pasuk. Or, you know, it doesn't even want to talk about it. It's just like, it's too impolite to even discuss. So why am I bringing this up? I think this is because the attitudes that were prevalent in American culture and reflected in the films, let's say of the 1920s and 1930s, or maybe even 1940s, are not necessarily the ones reflected by Torah values. I think the Torah is a lot more explicit than that which would be acceptable in the by the 20s and 30s standards. So that's that little point is just I thought that would highlight that. So for example, would this film that we showed at lunch, would that have passed the censors? Would it have been acceptable, a film like that, in the 1920s and 1930s?
No.
I don't think it would have. I think I Love Lucy. I think they Ricky and
they weren't allowed to stay pregnant.
Right, they weren't allowed to stay pregnant. They, I think they were never, they were always in beds on the opposite sides of the room. But the question is the Torah, is that our standards? Is that what the halacha would expect? Or is the Torah, or does the halacha allow there to be a more explicit presentation of the reality, or does it require such a sanitized version of the reality, such as I Love Lucy? And I'm just raising that. Anybody have anything to share? Okay. Obviously, the rabbi who okayed that film and the film college that produced the film that you saw this afternoon, it actually has a rav that gives his okay or not okay to various aspects of the film. Obviously, he was okay with it. and he felt that that this would be it would be acceptable. The Torah is pretty explicit about many many things, and therefore we don't have to necessarily shy away about some more some of the more intimate aspects of life. Yes, go ahead.
But the fact that the Torah is explicit about it doesn't mean that it's meant to be publicized, right? Meaning, yeah, right. Halacha, obviously, you open up Ebn Ezer, and it's very explicit, but ain't darshan b'arayas p'shlosha, right? Right, meaning, just because, right, the Torah talks about it, right, if you're talking about it, something about visual media, right, there obviously are constraints, right?
Okay, so you're saying two important points you're raising. So first of all, you're raising the distinction, I'll go to the second point first, because I think it's just a little shorter, but that's something that I'm going to raise, that there's a big leap from the written word to the visual word. Now, we were talking about that a little bit before,
visual,
but Clapper did.
Not even visual, right, meaning... Ain't Dorshin Ba'arayos,
right? All right. So now, okay, Ain't Dorshin Ba'arayos, okay? So for those who are not familiar, that's a Mishnah from the second parak, the first Mishnah in the second parak of Chagiga. Ain't Dorshin Ba'arayos, but Shlosha means that you don't speak about the Arayos in the presence in a group of more than three. Now, it seems to me that you're understanding that the reason for this is because of Tznius. Is it because of Tznius or is it because of another reason? Anybody remember that Gemara? Why Gemara explain why Ain't Dorshin Ba'arayos B'Shlosha? What's that?
Or would people make mistakes?
Because there'll be misinterpretation. I don't think it says because of Tznius. So that's really the question is, how much does the Torah want us to be? You know, Tznius is a major value in the Torah. But on the other hand, the Torah, when it comes to, it does tell the story. It does not center out the story of Tamar and Amnon, Yehuda and Tam. I just writing it down. Yehuda and Tamar, Bathsheba and David, the Baal Peor incident. I'm going to show you. We have five pieces of Gemara. It doesn't shy away from it either. So if we are going, you're making a novel, you are making a film. Does it require? Obviously, Tznius is very important. The question is, does the Torah demand I Love Lucy standards? That's what I'm posing. Yes.
Another question we could ask would be: is there a distinction to be made between written and visual media?
That's a major point.
Right?
That is.
There are lots of things there are poems about that we would, right? That they're explicitly serving as depicting visually, like this summer started with this one of the first shirim on the chorus sheet was Shir HaKavod. Right.
Okay.
Now, could you illustrate Shir HaKavod? Well,
right.
Not
yeah, right.
Human figures. So the question is, right, so certain things. Yeah, you know, I just got the idea from reading on the Gemara where the image of walking into the Bar Sheshach's apartment, right, and the scene there, is that a scene we would want, right?
Yes, exactly. Right.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly not. That's over the top. But was there, in the film that we showed you this morning, can anybody point to what was Tznius about the film that we saw this afternoon? Well, where was it Tznius? I mean, obviously, this was not the way that the films that are shown, certainly in the movies, but even on television, it's a lot more, it's a dramatically more Tznius. Can anybody point out what was Tznius about it? Anybody notice anything to know?
They never touched.
They never touched. None of the men and the women in the film touch each other. Okay? But does it convey? We were talking about this before a little bit, but is attraction conveyed?
I think so.
Okay? Very much so. Right? What also is expressed very subtly in this film? And in some of the secular films would probably not be expressed so subtly. What's the importance about showing the pregnancy test? If she's taking a pregnancy test, what does it tell you about the couple?
They're having sex.
They had a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
And that they're going for a get a couple of weeks later. Something's wrong there, right? That's one of one of the points of the film. How do they express that point? Do they show a flashback? You know, showing, of course not. That's not in a kosher film, wouldn't show that. But it hints to it in a subtle way, but not in an I Love Lucy way. I Love Lucy way, not going to have a pregnancy test. understand what I'm, you hear what I'm saying? So it's like a, it's kind of a balance between I Love Lucy and that, and the standards that are prevalent in many, in much of the media today. Any other thoughts? Yeah, Rabbi? Okay, I'm students first. Okay.
A lot of what sneeze has to do with is what you're used to seeing and what's in the culture being so new.
Right.
I mean, we could say that the Isle of Lucy standard is was necessary for the 20s and if you're in an Isle of Lucy society, then you have to use those, then that's the boundaries of sneeze. But if you're not, then
so what you're saying is you're raising a very interesting issue. If you were a Rav, right? If you had a pasuk in this issue in 1952, this film that we saw this afternoon, Willingly, if you saw it, that's the name of the film, Willingly. If you saw it this in 1952, you would say it was unacceptable. Because that was the standards of the society at that time.
I'm not necessarily.
Oh, maybe it's an interesting issue. It's an interesting issue, but what would be the problem of what would be the problem in doing that? What would be the problem of censoring it and removing any mention about the pregnancy?
Well, it certainly
test.
Wasn't suitable for children. It's about the boy.
Right.
Very bad.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah.
I'm just going back to Miriam's point. I mean, I think. Sneas, that's definitely true, right? I mean, for example, right, one of the classic examples in Poskim, right? Can, right, you look a few hundred years ago, right, the ultimate of preachers is having mixed Sheva Brachos.
Yes,
right?
They talk about, right.
And now, right, no one thinks, right, people don't think that, right, either they think it's Mutter Lagamre, or, right, they think, right, or they don't think it's, right, they don't talk about it that way, not because it was viewed as a Pirsa, the people who were doing the Pirsa, right, made it erotic simply because that wasn't accepted.
Right.
Sometimes with right, the erotic, what makes it erotic is the fact that you're pushing boundaries.
Right.
Right. So it isn't about objective. It isn't always about objective standards. It's about figuring out where the boundaries
so
are.
This,
and what's pushing
it. Was this film pushing boundaries?
Well, I don't know. Now, no. In the 1920s, maybe.
Okay.
Meaning one could plausibly make an argument.
For us, it's pushing boundaries in the other way. Here, the chiddush is, we're showing something where. With a sneer, right? It's a film that halachic Jews can feel comfortable watching. So, okay. Any other thoughts? Any other thoughts about the film? No, I'm sorry, Rabbi Clapp.
Could you take your argument about the Torah's openness and therefore possible extensions? How does that relate to Avodah Zarah as opposed to Raya?
Oh.
Where the Torah is really. Torah is really open about the attractions of the Avodah Zarah. It just conveys pretty explicitly people going and worshiping like Balfour. And yet it might be that we have a strong discouragement from talking about Avodah Zarah in any sense at all.
Right, because the Gemara speaks about Harchek Alecha, stay away from a base of Avodah Zarah. The Gemara even has a discussion, right, if you have a choice between walking on one side of the street has a Beit Zonah, the other side of the Beit of Avodah Zarah, which is the better side of the street to walk on? Yeah. I think part of what I'm going to try to get to in this shiur is that, is it necessary for the point to get across? Is it frivolous? Is it gratuitous? Or is it there? Or is the Avodah Zarah, or the Gilui Arayos, if it's presented in a subtle fashion, is it part of trying to achieve the goal that we're trying to accomplish, with the film or the piece of literature is trying to accomplish? Let me ask you another question. Who, raise your hand if you're familiar with the TV show Srugim? Okay? Okay. Can anybody tell us what is Srugim? Okay. Tell us a little bit about Srugim.
Israeli show about the Bethilomi community, like the ways of life of the dating and single and married, young married Bethilomi community.
Right. In part, right. Not everywhere in Israel, but in one section, right, in Katamon, right. So one element of the Bethilomi community in Israel. So what do you, okay, if those of you who've seen Srugim, Could you compare Srugim to willingly? What, any thoughts?
They touch, and they're a little bit more. They deal with any touchier situation a lot closer.
Uh-huh, okay. It seems to me, well, first of all, Srugim is about religious people, but it's not about... It's not all under rabbinic supervision. And in fact, it explicitly shows religious Jews violating religious norms. So one person told me, actually my son, I wanted to watch it with him. He said, "This is the worst show, Ted. This is terrible." He said, because it's one thing if you see people who are not observant of the Torah being presented as violating things, but here you're seeing people who are supposedly representing Torah, violating the Torah, and you're making a television show about it. He thought it was awful, and it's a terrible chilul Hashem. So that would be quite a difference between that and willingly. Just some thoughts to sprinkle about.
And so let's go back to it'll get to it. I guess at some point I want you to address what you think the value of the film is. That it would be important that you would allow things because they're non-gratuitous in this film, because the film, is that just because of the artistic integrity of the film, even if the point of the film didn't matter to you, or is it that this film is trying to make a point that matters?
Okay.
Alright,
so the point of this year that we're getting at this point, but that's okay. The point, this year, in summary, I mean, I'll say it right at the beginning, is to say that we can have subtle allusions, or maybe not so such subtle allusions, to Gilya Rayot, to Znut, or even just to not Znut, but kosher relations within a married couple, if there's a point. I don't think just because of the artistic integrity. That's my opinion. But if there's a point, I mean, what was the point? Does anybody think what was the point of this film? I think this film had a lot of good points. Question is, that depends how you look at it. Anybody have any thoughts about what was the point of this film? Any thoughts? Anybody? Yes?
I mean, it seems, I guess among other things, to be a sort of a statement about what it means to take a divorce seriously and what sort of flippancy in divorce is.
Right, and the consequences. Right, and that's, and it was saying that this couple, right, should they have been there in that, should they have been there in the basement?
I think the sense we're supposed to get is that no, they should not have been there.
They should not have been there. Why? Now I'm going to throw in my agenda. Why? At least my take on it. What could have prevented them from being in that basement? I mean, it was an awful tragedy. You realize she didn't want to be divorced. She was trying to do all she could to prevent it. You see at the beginning of the film, she was reading their old love messages, trying to convince him to not do the get. And then and then after the get, after the canceled get, what did she say? She's so traumatized. She said she's done. Unless she's playing hard to get, depends on how you interpret what she was doing. But it seems to me that she's gone. She's done. At that point, he now wants to remain married, and she's done. But that's a casualty of having been through that system. Had they been close with a rav should have been a rabbi, or some sort of a spiritual guide, should have been guiding them into a reconciliation, into marriage counseling, into building up their relationship, and never having been into the basin. The problem with the basin, they're there on their own. Now, are the dayanim, are the rabbis in the basin, the dayanim, are they playing at all a pastoral role?
No.
No. What are they playing? They're basically are they pastors?
They're functionaries.
They're functionaries. And that's it. And that's it. Really not too much different than selling comments. They're just there as a functionary, and that's it. Their personal concerns, the Rabbi Clapper thinks, that's why halachically the dayan said, look at your wife. Even though there is no such halachic requirement in Hilchos Gittin. You look in the Shulchan Aruch, there maybe there was a pastoral moment. But they need a pastor. In my mind, everyone needs a pastor. Everyone needs some sort of a spiritual guide that can help them make their to make good life decisions. This was a terrible life decision.
I thought they should have gotten divorced.
You thought they should have gotten divorced.
I was very upset at them.
Yeah, also.
That they should have gotten divorced.
Especially at the end, it seemed she had already made the decision and he had made the decision he was chickening out on her.
Right.
And especially the fact that the point he hesitated was, Mutaret l'chol adam.
Right.
It seemed like the point there was not that he actually cared about her, it was that he had some issue with her being Mutaret l'chol adam.
Okay. So therefore, let's go to the broader issue. What was the point of the film? And was it worth making this? Was this film a spiritual? Let me put it this way: was it a spiritually enriching film? Did it convey a point? Let me put it in this way.
I think it was a portrayal of various kinds of human nature in very difficult situations, and I can't think offhand if that has spiritual. Benefits, it might.
Does it have a spirit? Let me point the question another way. Do we need that film that we saw today, in addition to the Tanakh, in addition to all the stories in the Tanakh, the Medrash, the Gemara? Did it add something? Did it add something that we couldn't get out of the Gemara? I think it does, because what is it doing? It's portraying the situation of how Gittin are handled in Israel today. And that's not something that you couldn't get that from the Gemara. And the Gemara is only in a written medium. Here you have a film, and it's a much more powerful point that's made. I thought it was spiritually uplifting about teaching about the need for an intervention. Maybe if the Rav was, if their pastor was there with them, if their spiritual mentor was there with them, would have guided him and say, do the get. It's appropriate to do the get. Or maybe a spiritual guy would say it's appropriate not to do a get. I, as a Masada Gittin, that's probably I have a tense interest in this. Sometimes I will tell, when I see hesitation like this, I will say, just push ahead, go ahead, do it. I mean, I remember I have a situation where a woman said to me a couple months later, as she's remarrying somebody else, said, thank you for pushing me to insisting when we were crying at the get, thank you for pushing me ahead for doing the get. Other situations, people thank me for pushing them not to do the get. So there has to be, I think that's an important message that would not be gotten across. You couldn't get across that to our generation, people in our circumstances, merely with the stories in the Gemara, the Midrashim, and the Tanakh. And therefore, to me, it was a spiritually worthwhile film. And it's worthwhile doing. And even to the point of even having to the allusions with the pregnancy test. I thought it was worth it. Yes?
Interestingly, taking its value to be as something that presents the way Gittin are actually handled on the ground, this is not a journalistic piece, right? It's fiction. And they could, if they wanted to, portray it however they wanted, regardless of how the reality is.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the question is, what is, do you see the same value in fiction that you would see in sort of accounts striving to be faithful to, right, what reality is as it exists? And what value do you think?
If there's a point in it. No, there's Rav. I remember one of the first things I ever asked Rav Aaron Lichtenstein when I was at Gush was that what do you see spiritual? Why were you attracted to study literature? So he said to me, I find it. It's very simple. I find it very enriching. Now, what did he mean by that? He explained on other occasions in lectures that he felt that he's broadened. He said you're sensitized to various issues that you wouldn't be sensitized otherwise. Exposure to a wider range of human experience, not through far beyond your own culture and far beyond your own time. And that's something that's what's enriching and worthwhile spending your time engaging in. So fiction, if it's spiritually enriching, but if it's merely for entertainment, then it would be then I see no point in it. And I'm going to try to develop that just a little bit from the sources. Here, but I think the value of this film is I think it's very much portraying a reality of a problematic reality on the, maybe in our community, that there's not, I don't know if this was the intention of the artist, but there's not enough, not everybody's availing themselves of the spiritual guidance that they need. That's my thought on it. One other film I wanted to just think about, and then we'll take a look at these sources. Did anybody see, this is a film that I really like. Did anybody ever see Cast a Giant Shadow?
About
Colonel Marcus, Mickey Marcus, who was a colonel in the American Army who volunteered to help out the Haganah in 1948. Nobody saw the film.
Yeah, they show it in Camp Moshava every so often, I think.
Yeah, okay. Right. And okay, good. I'm surprised more people haven't seen it. So there in that film, it was made in 1965, so it's relatively tame. By today's standards, but still there were some scenes, some of the scenes there were beyond telling his story and telling a lot of the stories of the early part of the Milchemet HaShichrur and the Haganah's efforts before the Hakamat HaMedina, but there were some gratuitous moments, such as, that were not necessary, and such as they described Mickey Marcus as having an affair with one of the women of the Haganah that he was assigned to being with. So that, to me, was just not part of the story. It was just there for entertainment purposes. That would be frivolous and gratuitous and not necessary. But let me ask you about this. I'm just going to raise this. I want to hear what you have to say. They show questions. How would you put this in the written word? How would you put it in the? How would you put it in film? If we're doing this according to the halacha, they show a scene of Jews that are trying to break the British blockade not allowing Jewish immigration. One of the scenes are that there was one boat that managed to break the blockade, but then they reach the shore, but the British troops intercept them at the shore. And they're already going to round them up and going to put them into a camp in Cyprus, where they'll have to wait till to enter Eretz Yisrael. And if you know a little bit about the history, this was a very, very common event in the 30s and especially in the 40s after the end of the war, before the Hakamat HaMedina. So what the strategy that the Jews have, as portrayed in the film, is that a lot of the already people who are living in Israel, Palestinian Jews, right, they all flood the shore, and they try to mingle with these Olim Chadashim, these recent immigrants. But the British still can tell, right, they're wearing different clothes. One's wearing the Israeli kind of clothes, others are wearing just the ones that just came, more European clothes. They just came in from Europe. So what do? So one of the women came up with an idea. If you saw the film, Lachlif. Right. Let's change clothes. Right. And therefore you won't be able to tell who are the natives and who are the residents of the legitimate residents and the ones that just came in. And the film itself shows the actual changing. So I'm sorry for being so explicit, but this is what we're talking about. So any thoughts about this? How now? This was not frivolous. I mean, there was a certain point of how to show. This is an event. I don't know if it did happen, but it certainly could have happened, and it does give a flavor of that time and about the struggle that Jews were engaged against the British, and somehow the clever ways in which they managed to smuggle Jews into Palestine against the British regulations. So I think it was an important point to get across. But then again, you're sacrificing tznius. Certainly the film itself is not concerned about tznius, and it sacrifices tznius. So before I share my thoughts, anybody have any thoughts about this, about that scene that I'm describing? No thoughts? Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't seem hard to build that scene in such a way that it's not so problematic.
Right. Okay. Go ahead.
You figure out the angle of the shots.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So it could be that you could. like we're saying, you could do it subtly and get across the point subtly.
But if the point is that they had to be, for at least some amount of time, naked on the beach, and that was very uncomfortable for them. And
right.
They had, so part of, you don't really get that experience if the camera shies away from it.
Right.
Do you think it's really an important part of it, though? I mean, that's
no, I
just
mean, it's not extremely important, but maybe it's one aspect that you lose, and maybe that's...
If you ask me, I would say that's worth certainly in a film. I think that's worth sacrificing.
But also, I mean, even if the way that the camera shoots it, that you wouldn't see it in the movie, it would be okay for viewers of the movie. It would still be a problem for me as with everyone in the crew who was watching it, and so then maybe you would have to have some kid or someone in a conversation later, and it was, so funny, we fooled them because, everyone came and, switched clothes, which, of course, wouldn't be, as dramatic as seeing it.
Uh-huh.
But,
Right, so what do you do about the film crew? Right, that's an interesting point. Just to throw out an idea about the film crew, we have, you probably do the concept of an Uman, right? Uman Tar Bum Nase, right? Did you encounter that yet?
Okay.
Not yet? Okay, let's just throw this out. Whatever view on Kol Isha, just going to a question that I was asked. A friend of mine asked me about his son, that he's filming a girls' choir. And so I thought it wasn't a problem for Kol Isha because we have this concept that the Gemara and Avodah Zarah, that an uman, someone who's a professional, he's concerned about his umanut, about his profession, and is not going to be... romantic thoughts. So, for example, something that's very real application of this Gemara, is visiting a doctor of the opposite gender, right? Which is explicit in the Shulchan Aruch that it's mutar, right? So that's clearly allowed. Why was it a problem for the doctor? The answer is because he's a doctor. He's concentrating on his medical practice. And therefore, it's not an ironic experience. For us, learning Shira Shira, right? If you read Shira, what Pesach, all my Pesach and Shul, Ashkenazi Shul, you read Shira Shira. Why Svardim say it every Friday afternoon, right before Mincha? So why should that be allowed? I'm assuming you've all paid attention to Shir HaShirim. So why should that be allowed? If you're viewing, I think the answer is, if you're viewing it as Rabbi Akiva taught us to view it as Kodesh Kodashim, as a metaphor, then it depends on your mindset. Now, again, there's a difference between the word of Shir HaShirim, as you said, as opposed to putting Shir HaShirim to a film. Right? And it depends on the attitude. The Gemara, by the way, condemns very much using Shir HaShirim and making it into love songs. Because there, what is Shir HaShirim being used for? Shir HaShirim is being used not for any spiritually enriching purpose, but rather simply for entertainment. That's basically the idea that I wanted to share. Yes?
Yeah, two questions.
So for the film crew, I'm sorry, for the film crew, basically, to shoot that scene, as it may be, because there, it's not, they're concerned, they're working as professionals and not as... And therefore, the issues of sneers is a little bit more flexible with them. Again, it depends on what extent. I mean, you don't have to sacrifice sneer that much even in the film shoot. Yeah.
The first question I have is, if the filmmaker comes to you and says, and this would be an honest filmmaker, and says, you know what, I really think this scene is necessary.
Right.
It ties into a whole, it ties the whole movie together in all sorts of ways. I have three questions. I got lots of questions because of the newbie, right? So somebody comes to you, and you say, you know what, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Spielberg, but I've seen the film, and I think it could be done just as well if you move the camera rapidly so you just saw the clothing on the person and the hand being for the next person.
Right.
So is that your sock? That you, because the film, because you find it gratuitous, even though the filmmaker tells you that from their perspective it's a better film and makes them more powerful than the other way? Or is it
Yeah, I would rather sacrifice. All right, so the film is not as good. I think, you know, look, I think
should
it's not.
Should he ask you that?
I don't think, you know, we have an halacha. I think you should. We have an halacha concept of hutra versus dechuya, right? This is, have any of you heard of this concept of hutra and dechuya? Very important concept. Let's say certain things, when certain issues are put aside. Let's say Shabbos is put aside for pikach nefesh. So do we say, okay, hutra, right, that everything is okay? Or dechuya, you just do the absolute minimum. Like, so if you're driving, the wife to, your wife to the hospital to deliver a baby on Shabbos, right, then you're not going to put on the air conditioner. Right? You'll just do that which is necessary. You're not going to go beyond that which is necessary. To me, when you're dealing here with, on one hand, the enriching potential enriching value of the film versus Arayos, you have to be very careful to do only that, only the minimum. Using the example, let's say, of the doctor and the female patient, or the female doctor and the male patient. Everything should be done in that situation to try to maximize its tsniut. That which, oh, I hear what you, right, but I wouldn't say that if it's going to compromise the medical care.
But who gets to decide? Right. So, you would let the doctor paskin.
Right.
What's necessary medically, so why don't you let the filmmaker paskin what's necessary movie-wise?
Okay, right. This is an old machlokas Rabbi Klapper and I have about, you know, autonomy. You know, how much autonomy the halacha will grant. You know, is it as opposed to having the rabbi make the decision? See, I see the value. We had this big machlokas about family planning, right? 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, at a conference. Let me try to anticipate what your response is going to be. I'm going to say the rabbi is more objective. The filmmaker is out there; he's trying to make the best film possible. And the rabbi is more objective, and has put the brakes on it. But then you're going to say, Rabbi Klapper, but the rabbi is not an expert in filmmaking. How does he know how is he even qualified to do so? Well, I would respond to you, Rabbi Klapper, that the rabbi has to know what he was doing. I spoke about, with youngsters, I spoke about a case of machloket that occurred in a basketball game. We made a basin, one of the students at Torah Academy, where I'm a Rebbe, they broke the other person's glasses, and without getting into the details, the bottom line, it was a gray area, and I insisted that all the members of the base be people who had spent many hours in their youth playing basketball. They had to understand basketball, so the rabbi would need to have to understand film. He would have to have a sophisticated understanding of film. The rav was the posek for that, for the film school that made the film that we saw this afternoon. He is pursuing an MA, a master's degree in Tel Aviv University in film. So you want to have somebody who, he may not be Steven Spielberg, you know, but at least competent enough to be able to make that kind of a decision. But someone, you want that rabbi to be somebody who's sensitive enough to, he has an appreciation of the value of the film, the power of film. But I still think it needs to be, but still I think the rabbi needs to make that decision. I think the filmmaker there, he has one thing on his mind. You know, that I want the best film possible. Yeah.
But if the rabbi then becomes like an expert witness type for that specific issue, then first of all, that could create some kind of bias because he is so knowledgeable about that. Or second of all, like you were saying just now, then the filmmaker has only one thing on his mind, then in the same way the rabbi will only have, like,
right. I hear what you're saying. So the rabbi is only thinking sneers, and the filmmaker is only thinking artistic quality.
Or whatever it is, it's just saying you really want to have like a class of rabbis.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying? Where they're like experts on only one, like an expert film rabbi, an expert music rabbi, an expert whatever it is, like that.
Well, that's the way the world is evolving. The world is becoming, is a very complex place. And just like in medicine and law, or pretty much any field, the world is becoming a world of specialties and subspecialties. Since, because of the complexities of life the way it is today, rabbis really are, because we really do have experts. You have experts in kashrut, you have experts in business halacha. Definitely, that's a significant change from what was in the time of the Gemara, or was even 50 years ago.
Right. Like, to a certain degree, this is sort of the problem you have with any type of regulation. I mean, right? HIPAA was not written by doctors; it was written by lawyers. But you have to expect that there are lawyers who have a lot of knowledge about medical procedures are. They're educated in those. And the fact is, right? You hope that whoever's writing the regulations, right, are people who are writing regulations because they understand all of the to the extent possible, all the necessary components.
And they value medicine, right?
To that effect, right? If we're going like sort of hutra the chuya route, like by medicine, I understand. You know, you can clearly articulate what's being hutra or what's being the chuya means say what.
Right.
Right. Where you have Shabbos and you have pikuach nefesh, right? But how we really define like what is it? At least in Hebrew, what would we call it? That word that arayos here is being the chuya mipnei.
Well, I don't think it would be actual arayos. I think, let's say, in the film that we saw today,
right,
the allusion to the couple having being intimate very, very recently.
Right, okay, so whatever.
That's a little bit of it's subtle, but it's not so tsanua. But I think that was worth it in order to convey the powerful spiritual message that the film was getting at.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. It's like, halakhically, what language do you have to express that?
What halakhically? Well, okay, that's a very good question.
It's
a
issue,
very
like,
nice
okay,
question.
Because
right. okay. Well, so I'll use Mishnah Berurah's language. That's I'm jumping already ahead in the handout. Number four, source number. Okay. All right. Let me jump now and start to source number one and four. I'm just going to jump in there. But I'm going to jump back into our questions because I want to continue this. I'd rather a conversation than just resources. Source number one. I should have started out source number one because source number one, I just could have read it and just say, okay, that's it, I'm going home. Goodbye. Everything's up there. And some people would say, certainly in the Haredi community, they would say this shiur is one big what? One big waste of time, right? Because just look what it says in Shulchan Aruch. They say, look this. Melitzot u'melashalim shel sichud chulin v'divrei cheshek, kagon sefer Manuel v'chein sefer milchamot. Asur l'gram shabbat v'apuchol asur mishum moshav leitzim. Okay? If you have books that are just simply purely entertaining, certainly with divrei cheshek, if it's a romantic novel, books that have no, that are not, using Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's words, that are not spiritually enriching, right? It's usher not only on Shabbos to read, but even Chol, because of using the pasuk, the very first pasuk in Tehillim. Anybody know that first pasuk in Tehillim, right? What is it? Ashrei ish asher halach b'derech Hashem
v'moshe.
Right. So we're right off the bat in Tehillim, person stay away from Moshav Leitzim. Here's a little bit of a vague category. What's Moshav Leitzim? Let's say put a non-productive, an activity which is not, does not have, which is not enriching. I think believe it or not, and I'm going to say something very controversial now. The Torah wants us to be spending our lives, we don't have that many late years in this world, but in 120 years that hopefully that we're here, they should be involved, not with Moshav Leitzim, it should be involved with something which is valuable, which is enriching, it enriches your neshama, right? So if the literature is not enriching, then it's asur. But over mishum al tifnu elilim, pasuk tells in Parshas Kedoshim al tifnu elilim. The drasha is al lo tifnu el midatchem. Never remove God from your mind. God should always be on your mind. And if you're just deciding, I'm going to just, you're tuning out God, you're going to a religion-free zone on just pure entertainment without any without any enriching value, that is a violation of Al Tifnu Alilim, whether that's Doraita or Drabanan, good question, but it's quite interesting, Shulchan Aruch. With Divrei Cheshek, if it's a romantic novel, Ikasu Mishum Megare Yetzer Hara, you're exciting a person's passions, And look what he writes. Umishachi runs the Shulchan Aruch. The one who composed such a book, Umishachikan, and anyone who copies it, what does that what does it mean, Umishachikan? You always have to copy it. Well, what is it, why would somebody copy it? Before the printing press, right, good. You always have to remember the historical context. The Ein Tzorach Lomar HaMatfisan, right? If you, I think maybe that already, Latfis is to print.
That should have been one of the first books.
Yeah, that's one of the...
Ah, so now they are bringing it. This is already, so this is maybe one of the first
Psakim
about... That's
why the
about
key is Shulchan Aruch becoming as accepted as it is. It's written after the printing press.
Ah, okay.
It's the first code written after the printing press.
Oh, I see. Okay, interesting stuff. But, you know, that sounds right. And here maybe the first time we speak actually is he's alluding to the printing press. Anyone who does this, machtiim et harabim. They are not only chote, they are machati, they cause others to sin. That's pretty, so basically, forget about it. There's no, there's nothing going to talk about. Forget about the literature, films, that's it. Go home. Right? But, look at the Mishnah Berurah on side two, right? Source number four, I'm going to give you the floor in a second. He says, the aim b'chlal zeh, the Mishnah Berurah excludes Yosifun, you see, you know, they like Josephus, Sefer Yuchsin, what's that?
Josephus is a from rewrite.
Oh, it's a from rewrite of Josephus.
Yeah, it doesn't have
Masada
in it, which is important
to start. Ah! There's a big machlok, by the way, just parenthetically, there's a big machlokas Rav Gorin and Rav Neria, right, whether Masada was good or bad, right? Rav Gorin thinks that they did the right thing. Okay, interesting, separate discussion, maybe for another summer. Okay. Divrei Yamim Shel Ri Kohen, I don't know who that is, V'Shevet Yehudah, Shemehem Yilmadu Divrei Musar V'Yira, Alkein Afil Ksum V'Laz Shari. Even they're written not in Hebrew, still permitted. So these books, and I don't know what, except for the Yosef one, these are acceptable, these books, even though they're not Torah books. Why? Look at the Mishnah Berurah's criteria. Shemehem Yilmadu Divrei Musar, right? It'll improve your character trait. V'Yira, and it'll improve your it'll prove your neshama. It'll prove your awe, your relationship with Kadosh Baruch Hu. Now, that's to him. That's what justifies literature for the Mishnah Berurah. Musar and Yira. From a modern Orthodox perspective, I quote Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and add enriching. I don't know if the Chavetz Chaim would say that Milton is qualifies as something that you can learn different Musar and Yira, but we'll broaden it a little bit to spiritually enriching. So take a long way, it was a long answer to the question that was raised. So that's what it's, artistic value per se is not the issue, but you need to justify an activity so there's not Moshav Leitzim. That's in my humble opinion. Yes.
So I'm just wondering, I feel like halakha can often look at literature in sort of too much of a flat way, because what if you have a book that's sort of, it's all about, I don't know, idolatry or avodah zarah,
right?
Something that seems so explicitly usher, but the whole book is supposed to be satirical about how foolish and empty avodah zarah is.
Right.
Well, so you just read a book that, you know, let's see how shot, I guess, and
right.
Totally, totally usher.
Right.
To this degree, but in reality, if you get the real, like, off of the book,
then
you understand that it's like, you know, a work of genius.
Okay.
So I'm just saying halakhically, like, where would that fall? Because I feel like halakha often doesn't take that into consideration. It looks at it straightforward and says, well, I mean, it's clearly at least there's a level of, you know, that it's about avodah zarah, therefore that content is out.
Why do you think that the halakha looks at it in such a straightforward way? What makes you assume that?
Because I feel like, especially with books, it's particularly subjective. That you...
What's subjective? The halakha or the book? Or the interpretation of
the book? The book. That it's subjective to how what person will respond. Well, people are, you know, have different intelligences, and people might not, you know, might appreciate books for different aspects of it, and there's all sorts of books. Like, I don't know. I feel like what would happen if these halakhic sources didn't address books? Would it really make such a practical difference? I understand with television or with the visual, but
right.
It almost sometimes seems like an unnecessary discussion that the halakha has about
Well, let me put it this way. Certainly, we learn, all of Gemara and learning Tanakh is all about teasing out the different layers of interpretation.
Right.
So if someone is a Talmud Chacham or is involved with learning and has been trained, as hopefully in the yeshiva system we do, at the very least, try to train people how to interpret text in a sophisticated way and to appreciate the different layers. Certainly, if the point of the book is a satire, but it's written, let's say it's written under persecution, so you have to read between the lines to understand that. So it would be mutar if it's for the appropriate person. So that's where the need for a spiritual guide.
Let's say it was something which is a satire in religious life, but if you read it simplistically, it looks like it's promoting religious life. Can you say that?
Just the opposite. Right. Just the opposite. Aha. Clever question.
Right.
Clever questions, right. These are all clever questions. Very good. Very, very good. I hear. I mean, I would say in that case, no. I mean, if the agenda is to belittle religion.
It's not even that clear. Let's say one scholar read the book and said, this is clearly a satire.
And
say, no, it's not.
Well, I hear you, but if my opinion is that if the book could even possibly be interpreted by a sophisticated reader, and certainly in Torah we're trying to develop sophisticated readers, then Jews hopefully will be sophisticated readers, then you don't even want to expose yourself to a possible reading of a book if it's there to belittle religion. That I would think would be not a good idea to read. My opinion. Rabbi Clapper, I interrupted you, but...
I got more and more.
Okay, that's good.
Let's start. You saw this movie, Casted Man Joe.
Yes.
It's got a gratuitous scene in it.
Yes.
Watch it again?
You'll ask me? Okay, I'm more conservative than you are. I'll watch it with a fast,
You'll watch it with a fast forward.
Yeah.
And you think that everyone here should, I mean, I'm reminded of the scene Deborah and I always talk about where we once chaperoned a group of Maimo kids and they wanted to watch a particular movie and we told them we think the movie's inappropriate scenes in it and they said, don't worry, Rabbi, we know where those are, we'll fast forward it so you don't have to see them.
So that you don't have to see it, right. That's a great moment there. Yeah.
But is that really what you're suggesting? Is that people, because it's not the same film once even if you think they could have done the film slightly, but it's not the same film once you fast forward. It doesn't have any right. Doesn't have anything in it. And
well, then don't watch the film. Well, I would say that you should be selected. Now, more conservative, people that are even more conservative than I am, I know it's hard to imagine, but people that would be even more conservative than I am would say, Al Tivieni Loli Dei Nisayon. Don't bring yourself to a Nisayon. As the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, David HaMelech, interprets David HaMelech, Bathsheba, he's testing himself. And he fails. So there you conclude that a person should not test himself. And it would be a nisayon to be watching this film, without the fast forward. I understand what you're saying, but my feeling is, even though your appreciation of the film would not be as your film watching experience will not be as great. If you fast forward, then if you didn't fast forward, I still think the needs of Arayos, of Tznius, really would demand that we would fast forward it.
Now, in other movies, the scene is mutter if you watch the film as a whole,
right?
But not if you watch the clip on YouTube.
Okay.
Is that what you're saying? Because it's mutter, right? Because it's mutter, is it? Right, it's mutter if it only conveys that point in the context of the film.
Well, just to clarify what my opinion is, at least my opinion now, I might change it between now and the time we finish, decades. But to my mind, the only time that I think a kosher film would be able to compromise tznius when it's done in a subtle way. That's what I meant. But let's say a film, to me, I think that just showing, let's say, the changing clothes scene, that would have to be done in a subtle way.
But even that, would you look there if you just watched it on YouTube?
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. That's a very important point. What you're saying is the context really changes the way you look at it. And therefore, let's say Shir HaShirim. Why Shir HaShirim, Mutar? Well, if you're in shul and sitting and reading Shir HaShirim, that's a very different context than when Shir HaShirim is made into songs, the Gemara speaks about in Sanhedrin also, that just for entertainment purposes. Yes?
Okay, I'm going to pick up on a detail here. But before, right, you said that, okay, so let's say that this movie overall was fine. This scene is slightly gratuitous. And then someone asked you about, what about the people filming it?
Right.
And you said it's fine because of Oseik B'Malachdam, right? I just want to get...
Yeah, I didn't say that exactly.
I just want to finish the sentence here.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry.
Right? So let's just... Right? So, clearly, right, you read Shulchan Aruch here, right?
Right.
Right? The clear implication is not... Right? There's a secondary problem, right? The assumption that something is legitimately Oseik B'Malachdam requires one to assume that the result is something worth having. For example, right? I'll take the extreme, right? I could use Oseik B'Malachdam equally well for someone creating a pornographic movie. But since we think pornography is usur, no one's going to say Oseik B'Malachdam applies to the head there, right? The assumption that you can use Oseik B'Malachdam, right, for that scene,
right,
right, assumes that you think that scene is worth, for example, right, Shulchan Aruch right here, right, Divrei Cheshek, right, someone can say he's making his money by Divrei Cheshek, but because we think that publishing and having people read Divrei Cheshek is usur, we don't view him as an Oseik B'Malachdam trying to make a living. We view him as a Chote U'Machti as Harabit.
Right.
Right? So the entire category, right, is the same reason, right, while someone may be seeing the same things if he is, right, creating a pornographic movie or if he's an OBGYN,
right,
the reason one of those gets, right, might get an Oseik B'Malachdam head and one of them is not going to is because
right.
of the result. Right? It's because we assume that one of those results is legitimate enough.
Right. But right? It's, but not only the result, in the process also.
But let's say that was the only, you know, job that someone had, right? He could say that, you know, doma alai, right, ke chiyure, agree, whatever.
Yeah,
right,
right.
Right?
Could you explain what you just said, doma alai, ke
chiyure? We did this, right? Someone.
Yeah.
Right?
Kaki chivri, right.
Right, right.
The so, white duck.
Right? Someone could say that, right? But my point being that Oseik B'Malachdam, right, assumes that you value the result of the work, right? So it's just curious to me that you picked up that you were willing to say for the same scene that you thought was gratuitous and should never been put in, that someone could create that scene.
No, I didn't say, no. If it's, no, so I want to be clear, I want to clarify my position. If it's gratuitous, it would be usur to, certainly to watch it, in my opinion.
So what case would
and
be
it would be usur to make it.
So what case would it be mutter to
so
make?
To make, if it's a scene that's important to show, but will be shown in the film in a subtle way, but in the course of the film, like the beach scene, that's an important scene to show. Not just showing Mickey and Marcus having an affair with one of the members of the Haganah. That's gratuitous. Never should have been in there. Us of the film should have been filmed. But the beach scene, if it was done under kosher auspices, would, in my opinion, would have been. You make the film you show it with the proper angles, and if it would be provided that during the exchanging the clothes scene, it would, you know, at least a minimal amount of sneers would still be preserved, then for the filmmaker it would be okay. But it's not frivolous. You understand what I'm saying? It's
so
not frivolous.
You have three categories. Or you have things that are perfectly fine and positive. You have
right.
things that are so usur that to create it, right, has no redeeming value.
Right.
And then things where
there's no spiritual, there's nothing
redeeming
spiritual
value,
redeeming.
But you have to do something that would otherwise be usur in order to get it to the point where it has redeeming value.
But I'm not saying the end justifies the means. I'm
right.
saying that
right,
the means is not usur because your
right,
work as a professional.
Right,
just
but
like
I'm
as a male,
that,
as a male gynecologist.
Right, but what I'm pointing at is that requires you to give value to the result because you...
Obviously, the only way,
which
right, that's
that,
a very important
which,
point.
Which means what comes down to, is, right, the real question in this, right, is the valuing of the result, is the assessment.
That's correct. That's 100% correct. Do you see any value in making films like the one that we saw this afternoon?
Right, but you could also say, right, to the person making the pornographic movie, right, fine, I believe you that Lesiero saved from Malacco, but it doesn't matter because that's not something you're supposed to be doing anyway regardless.
Exactly, that Malacco shouldn't
right.
be.
Right, yeah, but like, the same like somebody, right, who's engaging in embezzlement, right? I'm not saying you shouldn't engage in embezzlement because
right.
I think being in that place is not good of your eyes and damage yourself, because that's an awesome thing to be doing.
Exactly.
Right,
so
but,
right.
But of course there were things that you know, there'd be things that you could think, one could plausibly say is Usser to create and Mutzer to utilize, right? Or a positive utilize.
Like Kilayim, you say?
No, for example, the famous Truva of Ramosha,
right.
Right, that someone asked him before he got married, can he read explicit literature, which presumably was Usser to make.
Right.
Right. He's not getting it from, right?
Right.
He's not getting it from a rabbi. It's something, right, that's explicit.
Right.
It may have been Usser to write, but Ramosha
right.
said it was Mutzer.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, like a day of the wedding. I mean, he gave right?
He said only when it's really close to the wedding.
Yeah, yeah, he gave
right.
a very
he had,
limited
right,
hint there, right.
Right, but the point of that Jewish emotion is that he thinks that it's something that, in a vacuum is a bad thing to have, but contextually can be used anyways.
I don't think he said that it was, I don't think Rav Moshe meant that in the tshuva. I thought Rav Moshe meant, and it's been a while since I read that tshuva, when, are we lost? I mean, does everybody understand? Rav Moshe has a tshuva where he was asked, you know, a young man who's getting married asks Rav Moshe, right, is he allowed to read manuals that will instruct him how to conduct himself when he gets married? So Rav Moshe said, right, only if it's, very, very close to the wedding. So it depends, it depends what's, I don't think per se it's usher. I mean, learning how to be a confident spouse, I don't think is not usher. But if someone is reading that, and he's not married, then he's not doing it for a positive purpose.
Right, because with that, highlights the importance of content.
But that book that he's reading is not a pornographic book. You know, it's a book how to be a confident spouse. Which is a good thing, which is a positive thing. But if it's outside of that conduct, then it would be it's also. But if it's not for that purpose. The purpose justifies the activity, just like the male gynecologist. The purpose the process, not just the result, but the process, what justifies what he's doing. Okay. Are we ready to look at some makoros? There's more grappling. This is very good with grappling. I want to write this up in an article. The problem is there's a lot of stuff that comes out in the Torah Shebaal Peh. Is anybody recording some of the things that I'm saying? Because I'm not, because, oh, you have the tape. Oh, that's good. Okay. Thank God you exist. Okay, good. What's that? Yeah, why not? That's great. I'm glad. To preserve these moments. The most upsetting thing is, sometimes in the height of grappling, with an issue, you come up with some great solution. Like Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan said when Reish Lakish used to attack him with all these questions, then he finally, he came up with a halacha. But sometimes, it's not recorded and you can lose it. So Baruch Hashem. Okay, good. Okay. All right. So let's see if we can go through the handout. Again, interrupt me. The grappling is what makes the shiur all worth it. All right. We went through source number one, which seems to put a large limitation on looking. I'm sorry, at a lot of literature. And according to some, if you'd be more charedi, you would be all literature. All right, but we're not taking that approach. Let's take a look at 2A and 2B. 2A is already more relevant to movies. Listen to this. Gemara Brachos, a couple other places in Shas, Makos, Bava Basri, you have a similar Gemara. It says as follows. Ha'over acharei isha b'nahar, ein lo chelek olam haba. Now, sometimes, you should understand, sometimes Chazal speaking hyperbole, so just don't flip out about it. Saying that the Gemara says that a man who walks behind women by the river does not have olam haba. Why a river? What's going on? Anybody have any? You can sneak a peek in Rashi. No, the Gemara wouldn't have to say that. That's for sure. The guy doesn't. This guy doesn't. this guy is like, you know, with a Monopoly, you know, he's going straight to Guyana. That's anyone who does that, okay?
Oh,
but,
okay.
No, we're talking about do not pass go, right? What is it?
Do
not collect $200, go straight to jail. Forget it. That guy is finished, okay? But here we're speaking about something a lot more tame. Listen to this. See, so Rashi explains. He says, "Acharei eshet ish," and I think it's lav dafka married woman. I think it's I think just in, I think in the time of Rashi, in the pre-modern, I don't know, pre-modern, certainly in medieval times, if a woman was already mature, of a mature age, almost always she was married. It's a fair, in the Chumash, speak about a basula, right? Speaking about, normally is that someone who's, okay, unfair, okay. Okay, Rabbi Clapper disagrees. Okay, good. Just for the tape, Rabbi Clapper shrugs. Okay, all right, now. Okay, good. Okay, it was a legitimate shrug. I hear, fine. So, let's leave that for the moment. I was almost going to talk about sense.
Can we have this as a verbal discussion for those of us?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I just...
Oh, for those of us who are going to hear the tape.
No. For those of us who don't know what the shrug meant.
The captain wanted to extend this to apply even to sexual harassment of unmarried women, and to say it's a lot of good, and to make a historical argument in the sense of that, and I wasn't so convinced that I should have.
Thank you for stopping us. That's good, you know. Okay, good.
I mean, the first girl is thinking you got married really, really young, right?
Sometimes.
Yeah, 12. That's what's in the Chumash. It's a pretty based, you know.
Well,
yeah.
There's a lot of different.
Nara,
what
do you know?
Already in the Gemara, people are getting married at 24.
Oh, yeah, that's
right?
True. Yeah,
but,
that's right.
But it's moved back and forth, right?
Yeah,
but
not
the women,
not
I think the women
not
would get married.
Not friends.
Exactly. It doesn't go just in one direction, right?
Like right, because by friend, you know, friends and the Bali Tosfos, they're all getting married before Bat Mitzvah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, at least in the Kabbalah Kedushin, I don't know if that actually means doing anything. What's that? Okay. Okay, good. All right. So, what used to happen? What? Women, why would women be by hang out by a river in the in pre-modern times? That was the laundry machine. Right? That was the washing machine. And what would happen because of the water? My best goddamn if now mayim. Right. So you'll pardon me. Just why would this guy go there? Because there the women would lift their skirts a little bit because of the water, right, and get all wet from the water. Vizem is takelba, and he looks at it. So this guy is
why he's there?
Yeah, that's why he's there.
As opposed to he can't be there because he might.
So he can't go like.
That's why he's going there. This guy's going there because you know. Now, what do you suppose? This is not foreign to us. Many of the poskim apply this gemara to what situation?
Would it be like
what
would
be the contemporary circumstance?
Like looking up, like on a tall stairwell.
I'm sorry.
On a stairwell.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Someone takes advantage of. Right. Someone exactly. So that guy ain't okay like Olam Haba.
So it's so what's it called? Like you, it's like I don't know. Like it's not like you can't say like a man can't go on a stairwell and there's a woman there because you could like go on the bottom and not know someone is there.
Right.
But you would be saying that like you can't go in the middle and look up to see like.
You can say that again, right? Exactly, right. He's got to act with sneers, right? For sure.
And also, people who are making shoals should be careful that they don't do the ones without the stuff in the middle.
Right. That's right. Okay. So, so what do you suppose Rabbanim, source 2A and B? What do you suppose many contemporary Rabbanim apply this to? Yeah, right. Rav Vagio Seif. You know, he has a tshuva in Yechavada, he was speaking about, already the title, the tshuva already gives you a point. Chumrat ha-yisrul al-litrochetz bayam, you know, so he already gets across the point. Oh, you know, it's really, really bad. And this is the Gemara, that's straight out that he quotes, because many men go to the beach, specifically for the reason why this guy is going to the Acharei Isha Banah, and therefore, why am I bringing this up in terms of creating film? That's why I was saying before that to actually show on film people that are not dressed the way they should be is not something that we can compromise. In other words, what I was saying is that the subtle points to hint at the fact that this couple were having relations just before they went for the get, that is appropriate. That if it's there for a purpose, not just to entertain us, that would be for a mussar, right? That would be that would be acceptable and positive. But if it's but nonetheless, to my mind, no compromise in terms of what actually shown on in the film.
What if it's for no purpose?
If it's for no purpose,
meaning that, like, it's the scene that you said was unnecessary. That
right.
So in that context, maybe they thought it was for entertainment. But let's say they were doing it in which they had that scene in there because they wanted to be an accurate historical portrayal.
Okay.
But it had no.
Good. I'm glad you raised that.
The way you understood this Gemara, that
right.
That's why he went to the Nahar in order to see her. If the scene isn't in order to be.
Uh huh. Okay. Okay. Fine. Okay. So. Two things. First of all, I interpreted this Gemara speaking about that someone, that's why he went to the Nahar. Others could interpret this as Rav Agio Sevin, as Tshuva does. He says, even that's not his purpose, the fact that he's exposing himself to the spiritual risk, that itself is very problematic. So therefore, he shouldn't even be, if he has a neutral purpose of being there, and even Rav Agio Sevin's view, even if there's a positive purpose, he needs to go, if he has a skin disease, he needs to be at the beach, to help him for skin disease. Rav Ajayasev says no. Rav Moshe already doesn't agree with that. But he's matir to go to a mixed beach if you're going for medical purposes. Rav Ajayasev would say no. So Rav Ajayasev would clearly say, for accurate historical portrayal, that would not justify compromising tznius. But I would say, and I'm gonna drop a bomb. I think a lot of people are going to go crazy about this. Question is it worth being historically accurate? In other words, is everything in the past worth knowing? Is it, now I don't know whether Mickey Marcus or not, I don't want to speak lashon hara about him, I don't know whether he had this, an affair. I know he's portrayed in the film as having had this affair. And the film already tells you right at the beginning that they take some liberties with the truth. Even if that was historically true, I would say that it doesn't make sense to say that in my mind, I don't think that it would be halachically, I don't think it's mutter to tell that story.
Well, not that being historically
even if
accurate,
it's accurate.
Not that being accurate is a value and therefore, I was just trying to come up with a case of non-value, because if reading the Gemara the way you originally read it,
right.
The point is that the guy is going there for that purpose.
Right.
Meaning if the guy wasn't going there for that purpose, even if it's not, I mean, it's not always a positive value or a negative value.
Right. It could be neutral, the way I interpret it. But, right.
So,
but,
I mean, the historical accuracy would then be an example of a neutral argument.
Right.
Well, it's not that we value historical accuracy.
Okay. But I don't think certain things in the past that are negative, it's worth recording. So it's just Mechirat Yosef. It's worth recording Mechirat Yosef. Why is that not Lashon Hara about the brother selling Yosef? It's important for us to know. It's a toelet. It's for a purpose. The Lashon Hara, to be in very broad strokes, is permissible if there's a toelet. If there's not a toelet, then it would not be mutter. So for historical accuracy, I don't think just the value of historical accuracy, I don't think justifies Lashon Hara, unless there's a toelet, unless there's a purpose in us knowing it.
Let's say it was lack of tznius.
And tznius as well. I don't think, and again, the subtle lack of tznius, not the explicit lack of tznius, I see no heter for. But the subtle lack of tznius, I don't think would be permissible if it was just for historical accuracy. Now, I can hear someone's going to want to make, to say, well, Rav Moshe allows you to go to the to a mixed beach for the purposes of refuah. So maybe for artistic value, maybe for historical accuracy, it would be permissible. I personally don't think so. I just don't think that it's worth sacrificing tznius for just pure artistic value or pure historical accuracy if there's not something that's spiritually enriching. My view. Yes. I know you disagree. Yes.
Well, it's not so much that I don't disagree with that specific judgment per se, and that I don't think there's much worth sacrificing for the sake of historical accuracy if the historical accuracy is trivial.
Right.
But the question that always interests me is, let's take how does Kant write the really wonderful film he made us see? So Urim and Thummim are getting. So for you, it turned out that film was about the need for the kind of pastoral counseling, right, and you're a shulva, right, where you've been a right about. So
yeah, I am a shulva.
You're American.
Right.
So Americans have, do you have this, right, so it makes sense to you that the film is really about the need for a personal relationship with the Rebbe.
Right.
Now, one of the things that I learned this year in the lecture series, I brought in Adam Furziger.
Right.
And I asked him this question, why are Israeli rabbis... Dr. Adam Furziger is the head of the... he works in the Rappaport Center for the Study of the Aspera Judaism.
And he's a shul rabbi in Israel, right?
He's a shul rabbi in Israel. But he's also a sociologist. He's one of the leading sociologists of modern Orthodoxy in America and Israel right now. So I asked him this question, right? All the American rabbis are always critiquing Israeli rabbinism. Right? Why don't you have relationships with your congregants the way we American rabbis do? Why is it that Israelis don't have these pastoral connections? And he said to me, you're totally off the ball. You can listen to him on tape if I'm misrepresenting him. Israeli rabbis aren't rabbis of shuls. Israeli rabbis are rabbis of cities. They have 50,000 congregants. And their job is to maintain a bureaucracy. There is no such thing, there's no possibility, there's no position that is parallel to the American Rebbe in Israel except in a few narrow Anglo communities. So the Havanah, that a film could be made, right, that talks about why these people should have a better relationship with their Rebbe, there is no such thing. And to me, right, we know with that lens, that's not what the film is about. I might say this film is about the failure of religious life generally to get people to understand the important things in life. Because here are people, they presumably grew up from, they really are from, they might even be Shomer Negiah, we didn't see her when she was Tmeah, right? But they might even be Shomer Negiah in marriage, which is a tremendous thing. And yet they have no conception, it seems, of what it means to build a relationship. The ritual of the get is, you know, it's something they expect to just happen. You can't believe they have to wait online, right? And fundamentally, they're shallow people, right? They're interesting people, they're compelling people, but they're shallow people.
Right.
And so it's just a critique of the whole Orthodox life. It's
okay, and do you think, is that good to show on film, or is it not good to show on the film?
So for me, I could say it's valuable for me to understand that I have failed for many of my students. Right? It's good to challenge me, right? Because the film challenges me to think about whether in fact what I teach my students is likely to lead them to live deep lives in which they value what's important and not the trivial. But somebody else could look at the same film and says, this teaches me about how fundamentally religion isn't important. Because what really matters is, right, is the capacity to form deep human relationships, and here the people are, they keep all of halacha, and in the end, despite that they keep all of halacha, their lives are trivial, right? So they can talk about backpacking, right, but backpacking while getting divorced, they can make decisions about whom to marry, right, in the spur of a moment, they don't have any real conception, who to stay married to or not, there's a decision they make momentarily, they have no framework for deciding whether to tell their husband that they are or not pregnant before going for divorce. And fundamentally, what the film does is it shows you, that's how I'll call it big deal. The film does well, if it does it well, is it shows you two human beings in a real life situation powerfully. And then, Tzadikim Yeltsubam, the Poshim Yikashlubam.
Okay, but that's there's so much in Torah, which you just said, it's a very important phrase from Hosea, and the Gemara uses it quite frankly. Tzadikim yelchu bo, poshim yikashlubam, right? That tzadikim will use it in the positive way, and poshim could go in the wrong way. So that, even though that film could be used as a means to convince somebody there's no point to keep halakha, someone could interpret it that way, but again, that's a poshea, that's a choice, that's a wrong interpretation, I'm not wrong.
See,
that's an interpretation that one, what's that?
I want to push that. The film's not about the less the message.
Right.
The film.
But there's a muster. But there's a muster in
no,
saying that
you put the muster in.
Yeah.
All human situations.
Right.
Conveyed powerfully.
Right.
Have muster for tzaddikim.
Right? And I would say all great works of art.
Right.
All art done with true intent. I'll frame it as strongly as I can. I don't know if I pulled it this strongly, but all right. You were trying to distinguish between the Musar Haskell.
Right.
The didactic function of the work.
Right.
And the artistic integrity.
Right.
And I could take the counter position. No, any work done with artistic integrity will teach Musar to Tzadikim.
Right.
Not to Koshim. So the measure of a work can't be the Musar that you get from it. The measure of the work has to be whether it's well done. A well done work will find an audience that appreciates it and gets the Musar out of it. And a badly done work probably won't. But it can't be what you think you get out of it, because you think you get one thing out of it, somebody else thinks somebody else will get out of it,
okay.
And that's never...
Okay.
You should be able to judge is whether it's done well.
But just to frame it in terms of source number one,
yeah.
Source number one, what Shulchan Aruch is calling Moshav Leitzim, is not a high-quality work.
Well,
you're speaking about a great
today.
Work.
We just did it today. There's a huge machlok in that Sefer Emanuel. I pulled out the Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
In the current on Sefer Emanuel, which says, it says Riflet has not fared well with later critics, such as Joseph Caro.
Oh, okay.
who declared it. But there are works that some people might declare... You can see, on what basis is the Posek supposed to decide that Romeo and Juliet is the Rechesek or spiritually enriching?
Well, there's a difference between to decide what specifically are something worthwhile reading. And such as Romeo and Juliet,
as opposed to
something which is a novel that's purely for entertainment. It's hard to come up with specific halachic guidelines, but someone who's an expert should be consulted. Let me give you an example.
Well, it depends on the individual,
right?
There's some autonomy.
So that's Rabbi Jatt and Rabbi Clapper Machlok, about the autonomy. Well, let me bring up a big issue that we were grappling a lot at the Rebbeim and TABC and the staff, the Rebbeim and the administration. This is behind closed doors. I'm saying, I'll reveal this.
Hold on, please.
That's okay. One of the big issues, well, a lot of the boys complain about some of the literature that's being taught. Is that there are scenes, let's say in Catch in the Rye, why are we reading these? Is this necessary? So one of the decisions was made by Rabbi Adler from the principal at TABC was he spoke to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and to decide what would to get a sense of what should be studied, what should not be studied. This was done also in the Yeshiva High School in Boca Raton. Rabbi Perry Tershwell is the principal. He's a Gush graduate, and he for the English literature curriculum, he consulted Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein basically gave him a curriculum for English literature.
That's the curriculum. Do you also give kids a list of the books they can read outside of school? And tell them that they can only read books outside the school that Lichtenstein read first? Who read Lichtenstein's books?
Oh, yeah.
Right. The Halachic Post came, if they're censoring movies and saying, well, this is Musar and this is Usser,
right.
That they saw the Usser ones too.
Right. Right.
So.
Well, sometimes you, start reading something or watching something and you're like, this is trash. Or
that's
really
it. It's over.
And
right.
Stop.
I volunteer for the science fiction first.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or Oedipus Rex. I went to Maimonides and we read it in ninth grade or something.
Well,
and
there's just a
like
lot
one of the most brilliant things I've ever read.
Well, there's just a lot of gore.
I mean, it's gore, but the content too is obviously extremely.
No, I mean, all that. That's a Vodazara.
On so many levels, it's problematic, I guess, halakhically, but. I still think it's such an important work. It's like, why is it so? Does the halakha really not allow for any
like room for autonomy where I can make my own judgment call as I'm.
Well, that's where. Okay, obviously we don't have a system, you know, in our world that there's certain, you know, we don't have like a website of Ravon Lichtenstein approved literature and not approved literature. So maybe right, maybe we should make one.
Well,
right, I put OU for various books. You know what? We don't. In practice, what we do in our community is we do grant that autonomy. But at the very least, I would hope that our students should be sensitized to the point where they should at least be thinking about these things. See, in the Haredi community, there's a lot of grappling that's not done. The grappling that we're doing today is usually not done. In the Haredi community, it's all Oster. In our community, it's all Mutter. So what I'm saying there is, there needs to be more grappling. Just needs to be more grappling. And there needs to be a distinction made between great literature, like you're saying, a great work, and that which is done, which is not less than great, and it's just for pure entertainment. Now, what are we going to do? We're going to have it rated G, you know, great literature, you know, for... But at least there should be, even if you can say there's autonomy, there, at the very least, we should be thinking about it, should be sensitized about this. Because unfortunately, a lot of times people in our community view film, we view TV as a religion-free zone. Okay, I turn off my religion here, and I can watch whatever I want.
Right, and that's hugely problematic.
That's hugely problematic.
I just think that religion could also become oppressive if it says that we're going to put the OU stamp on every movie. Some rabbis.
Yeah, obviously we don't. Obviously, in our community, we don't do that. Obviously, we don't do that. Well, we don't do
that. You can eat DVD.
Right, right. Well, food, you know, needs a clear expert. You know, so complex food production today. You need rabbinic. You know, a rabbinic decision that's made upon
less complex talking about movies.
No, but with that is, I think there is a social contract. I mean, that we do give up some form of our autonomy in order, like with kashrut, and say, okay, I'm not the one looking in all of the companies because we trust it to someone else.
Right, and it's a full time job. You wouldn't be able.
It's a full time job, and we have a whole system for it. But I feel like it's different than. I mean, that's something that either way. I mean, we need. Sustenance. With this, it's like if I want to read a book, well, if some rabbi has really different tastes than me, he might think that all of Shakespeare is meaningless and he likes science fiction or fantasy or whatever it is, or vice versa. It's like...
Right. So the autonomy, one could say, is, this is, you know, I'm not so pro-autonomy as Rabbi Clapper, but my view of autonomy, and I do define myself as modern Orthodox, my view of autonomy is that you have a choice which posik to go to. In the Haredi world, they'll say, no, you don't. You know, there's a gadol hador, it's Rav El Yashiv, and you must follow whatever Rav El Yashiv says. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, we believe that you have the choice. I remember speaking to Rav Lichtenstein about this. It's one of the core machlokot that we have, is that the Haredi world will say that Rav Soloveitchik's view is a minority and you don't have a right to follow it. Rav Elyashiv came out against the Slifkin books, even though Slifkin is following and even for writing, quoting things from Rav Shamsham Fol Hirsch. Even because he's saying that is, because for Rav Elyashiv, these approaches of Mar Nebuchadnezzar type approach is out of the Masorah. So he's really restricted. That's a severe restriction on autonomy. So I'm saying a more conservative with a small C modern Orthodox approach would be that you have the autonomy to choose which of the halakhic authorities to go with.
Okay.
So at the very least, it's not realistic. We're not going to have a website of Ravon Lichtenstein approved books. But at the very least, I think what we can do is think, would Ravon Lichtenstein approve of this book? Would Rebbetzin Henkin approve of this book? Okay? You know, this is kind of like, you know, with the story with Yosef, right? By Ashes Potiphar, his father, that's, we should have that. You know, everyone should have a spiritual role model in their life, we'll say, they should think about before when they engage in an activity. So, yes, it's autonomous because you're making the decision, but that figure appears in front of you. You like that one. Okay.
I think we should have with food also.
Yeah, but that's, you know.
Food is different. Food is different.
I think you're looking to what he says.
But what about thinking about,
would not
about yourself before you read it?
I'm sorry?
But what about thinking about yourself before you read it? Instead of me always asking myself, well, does Rob Lichtenstein approve? If I say, well, wait, do I approve? And
okay. Right.
Okay,
in other words, the your hashgacha, you can give you your hashgacha.
Right.
Okay.
And it's not imposing it on anyone else. I'm not just giving
okay. Them. Okay, now we do this all the time. You know, this is the way we act. Now, but the question is, how do we give the hashgacha? If we're thinking internally, do we have, why are we making this decision? I'm making this decision, I think if you're going to make a decision like that, which is something that we do, you have to think, is this good for my neshama? Is this film, is this going to, will this cause my spiritual level to deteriorate? Or at the very least not deteriorate? Or hopefully even enrich it? But you're right, Rabbi Clapper. Tzadikim yelchu bo poshim yukash lubam. Right? Yisharim darkei Hashem. Yes, even the Torah can be misinterpreted and used for in a wrong fashion, but in an inappropriate fashion. But it depends on what your attitude, what your kavana is going into. We say that by Lashon Hara. Mm-hmm. So much of it is what's your kavana, what's your intention. So if you're going into that literature, that film, I think the bottom line is if we come out of this, it was worth doing, it's worth the whole summer, if before you see a film or read a book to think, is this good for my neshama or is it not good for my neshama? If you're already thinking in those terms, then you're great. But the problem is too often we think of, I need a break from the religion here for a little bit, I'm going to go escape for, that's something that's spiritually very damaging. And it leads to a personality, which is a schizophrenic kind of a person. I'm using a non-technical, a schizophrenic personality, not a wholesome neshama, where you're living your life in a consistent way. You know, you're an observant Jew for X, not for Y. You have this problem in general. You have people who bifurcate and say, well, when it comes to, it's across the board in the Orthodox world. Well, when it comes to business is a religion-free zone. Why? It's money. Got to make money. This is a religion-free zone. Well, I need to be entertained. I need to relax. So it's a religion-free zone. So we try to, it's just at the very least, if we can eliminate the religious-free zones, I think that would be a major accomplishment. Yes?
Okay, so if we're talking about something either being good for your neshama or bad for your neshama, so then I guess you could deal with that in terms of watching things or choosing what to like expose yourself to, but from the perspective of the artist.
Right.
So what if the kind of inclination is artistic expression, like wanting to have, I don't know how to define that, like wanting to be artistically expressive, and it's not about either this is good for my neshama or it's not, it's kind of this like impulse that's outside of that. And
okay.
I mean, I don't know if that's so much having to do with movies as much as like visual art that we dealt with more, but just like feeling this like need to express something artistically.
Right.
So I don't know if you can define that as good or bad for your neshama.
I think it's good.
Okay.
But it needs to be done in a wholesome way. I think, let me give you an example of that kind of an attitude. There's a huge machlokas. It's interesting. I couldn't include it in Gray Matter because it's just too controversial. I talk about exchanging lamps for peace. I talk about whether yeshiva students should serve in the army. But certain issue, but this issue, I couldn't put in Gray Matter. What's the big issue? And that is medical students taking a non-Shomer Shabbos residency. I censored it. I took it out. Why? Because the emotions run. It's interesting. That may be one of the biggest where the emotions run highest in the modern Orthodox world. I can't even discuss it. Why? Because those who are the doctors who sacrifice so much to go to a Shomer Shabbos residency, what do you mean it's mutter? What do you mean? I can't even court an opinion that says mutter. And those doctors who took a non-Shomer Shabbos residency, what are you saying? I'm a Mechalel Shabbos? So I can't even discuss it without, after I published this just in the Kol Torah, in the weekly bulletin from Torah Academy, I discussed this issue both sides. a doctor said to me that I decided not to send my child to TABC because of this article.
Oh, my
poor citizen. Well, he decided, but then he changed his mind. He did send it to TABC. But sometimes that's an emotion. That's an emotional reaction. But let's just—that was just a little aside. Let's talk about Rav David Cohen. He's a posik in Flatbush. Very out of the box about many issues. Worth listening to on certain things. Wait a minute, now I'm in trouble. Okay, but on all kinds of levels, I'm in trouble. But Rav David Cohen actually quotes from earlier posik that it would be permissible for someone to take the non-Shomer Shabbos residency if his Shomer Shabbos residency is not available, let's say in surgery. I think you cannot get a Shomer Shabbos residency in surgery. So he said if a person has this burning to be a surgeon, he would say that would be mutter. Now again, within limits, doesn't mean, okay, so now he can do anything on Shabbos. But he has to learn Hilchos Shabbos, he has to know it well, and to know and try to reduce the melacha that he does on Shabbos. But that burning desire that we have to become a surgeon, to become an artist, is something that is of great spiritual value. What's the greatest spiritual value? That's who you are. That's your identity. That's what you need to do. And that, it's, if you feel it's your life's mission, if it could be done in a wholesome way, go for it. I'm not saying if it's, and I'm going to use a crude example. So just to get across the point. If you're going to say, yeah, but my life's work is to film pornographic films, you know, that's obviously an extreme example. That's off the wall. But if to be an artist, that would be something. I think that's something very, very important. But it doesn't mean that everything is mutter. It has to be used in it has to be bounded by halacha, like everything else is in life is bounded by halacha. Because this is an important point. Shlomo Mel says al tit tzadik harbe, al tit chacham harbe, right? What is it? That's not exactly what Al Tidcha came to Yoter, something like that. Even though we value Tzidkut, we value Chochmah, but we never should take a situation where you have one value and excludes everything else. Even in Eretz Yisrael, if you have people that focus on Eretz Yisrael, and they don't consider other needs, then that's a problem as well. You always have to put balance out values, Shabbos, Pikuach Nefesh, Art, Tznius. You know, we have to create a balance for that. But the being like a batsala, so to speak, someone with that personality, being an artist, then that's a wonderful thing. Torah celebrates it. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, no, I have a question. So I mean, like a lot of what we're talking about is like low culture, which can very easily be low culture. Like just movies,
low culture. Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Like movies and TV shows and stuff, which you really should have a filter for, because a lot of it is just like, you know, really, it can be like trash or just really stupid. But about like high culture, like really like the stuff that's put in like art museums. So things like that, a lot of that can be like have other halachic issues, like. You know, like seeing a statue of a full human being or something. So do we say that, like, going and to look at something like that, would we think that it could have, like, enough value that we would be willing to look for a hectare, that someone could go to an art museum, even though to be able to look at the things there which arbitrary though they're full of stuff that's like mamish of Rodazara. Just look at like a statue, like, you know, even something that's like a statue, and like really look at it and like contemplate it for a very, very long time.
Right.
And it's like to be able to spend the time doing that and just to go into a place like that, that it has that, like, we would see the value in doing that we would look for a heterion to do that.
Okay, good. This is a very good question. So, a couple of things. First of all, there was an article in the current, there's an article in the current issue of Tchumen. You ever hear? You have to hear of Tchumen. Tchumen, you have to know what that is. Okay, Tchumen is, you must have volumes of Tchumen here. No, if not, you got to order it. What's that?
There's one volume around the business.
Okay. Tchumen is a great Torah journal, comes out in Eretz Yisrael, Torah, Chevra, Medina, Torah, Society, and State. It really grapples with a lot of very, very important issues. And you have the full range, and I don't think there's any other journal like this in the world. You have Rav Adi Yosef's son, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, writing. You have Rav Yasser's son-in-law, Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein, that writes for it. And you'll have some of the Yotzot Halakha right in there as well. So you have a... I hope I didn't insult anybody. I'm just saying, when those, it's a forum that will allow women to write halachic articles. You know, and yet it'll have Haredi contributors. I don't think there's anything. I don't think there's any other journal in the world, Torah journal in the world that's comparable.
Just out of curiosity, how do they pull that off?
I don't know. So I wonder. I do wonder that how they do. I don't know. Maybe it's an ace. I don't know. But it's great. It's how that happens, I don't know. But it's just so worthwhile reading. There's an interesting article in the current issue of Tchumen that discusses about the internet. And it's one of the articles I read in preparing this year. And one of the things he writes is that, speaking about David HaMelech of the Nisayon, he writes, he says, the chiyuv not to put yourself, it's also to put yourself into a Nisayon. And therefore he comes to the conclusion in the article, and I'm oversimplifying a 10-page article, it basically comes out to the conclusion that there's an obligation to put a filter on the internet. Now there you're speaking about low culture. So certainly that's a major distinction we've already said today. Low culture and high culture is a major distinction to put out. Now the question is for high culture, a great work of art. So my feeling is with this, when it comes to actually visuals, that not subtlety, that I don't see too much. That I don't see a heter for. I wouldn't look for a heter for that. And I would distinguish between, and this this is a definite maybe. I'm tentative about this. A distinction between avodah zarah and gilui arayos. Now, why would I say that? This is my feeling. Why would I look for? Why would I be okay with more with avodah zarah than gilui arayos?
That's
easy.
Yeah, why?
Because there's no yetzer hara for avodah zarah.
Right, exactly. So that's right, exactly. And gilui arayos, I mean, there's always the yetzer hara. But this generation, you know, just the media is almost like the avodah zarah of our time. So I know Rav Amital from Gush. He said, and he said this publicly. He said when he comes to Manhattan. You know, when he's been to Manhattan, he went to the cloisters. He said he went to the cloisters, right? You grew up in Washington Heights. What's that? You went to the cloisters? You didn't go to the cloisters.
I may have gone once.
You didn't go to the cloisters. Okay.
Not because of that.
Cloisters are part of a church.
I went to
a church. The church?
No. It was a monastery.
It was the garden of
them. The cloisters.
In Fort Tryon Park in.
Right. The cloisters was a medieval monastery in Europe. That was actually transported from Europe to America, and now is situated in Washington Heights in Fort Tryon Park, and it's basically it's the Metropolitan Museum of Arts branch for medieval art. Now, medieval art, there that's all it was, Christian art. Why wasn't there secular art? Because there just wasn't any. That's why it's not there in the museum. That was the only game in town at that time. So Rav Amital went. So there I think it's worthwhile coming up with heterim, because when it comes to avodah zarah, I don't think we have the Yetzer Hara is not there. But when it comes to gilui arayos, this generation always is there, and certainly this generation. I'm a big believer in. You know, the Ramban has this unbelievable idea. He says every individual has a nisayon, and no individual goes through life without a nisayon. Every generation, I believe, has a nisayon. The nisayon from my grandfather, when they came to America, is they had to feed families of five, and they couldn't get a job unless they were machal Shabbos. Well, what are they going to do? So Shabbos, that was a huge nisayon for them. So to my mind, the nisayon for this generation is arayos. So to my mind. In the current circumstance, I'm not one to. I wouldn't even if there's what to talk about. you know, that it's high culture and you, it's not pornography. You know, I personally, and this I got from Lichtenstein also, he felt that nudes should be.
So are you saying that like you can't go into the army then because there are nudes there, even though if you're like you're going to look at like other paintings?
No, that I didn't say that.
Okay.
I should say he should put on his filter, but I wouldn't. You know, if a boy asks me, you know, a woman who teaches art in a school, not in my school, but teaches in one of the other schools, asked me about showing Christian art. I said, show the Christian art. But I said, what about nudes? I said, don't show nudes. Even though you can give the same het there, it may be the same halakha category, and I can give the same heterim, right? But I just think it's not in our generation. Maybe she would have asked me 200 years ago, I would have answered, and you know, if I would have been alive then, maybe I would have answered differently. But I think you have to consider the context that we're in. Yes.
This distinction has been made by several people, but I can't for the life of me see why there should be a distinction between low culture and high culture. If the distinction is what is meaningful and what is not, then just say the distinction is meaningful and what's meaningful and what's not, because low culture can be meaningful to a lot of people, and high culture can be meaningless, right? Meaning, if you take someone, for example, we're at the MFA, right? For the life of me, right? Rothko may be considered high culture, but I cannot figure out the meaning in two colored boxes, right? I have no idea what that means.
Okay.
When Rosenberg did publishing his book on this, right? On lessons that people can derive from Harry Potter, which arguably is low culture. But there's no distinction in halakha between high culture and low culture. Maybe there's a distinction between what is meaningful and enriching and what is not. But high culture,
okay,
quote unquote, and low culture
is
a false distinction.
It's a good comment. Right, but the reason why I like it, because usually the high culture is intended to be meaningful, and usually the low culture is just
but
for entertainment.
It's
definitely
true. Low culture is often meaningful to a broader audience, right? Meaning, a real epiphany this year was the intellectuals and why you were making fun of the Maccabees video, and then you saw like hundreds of thousands of people saying this was the first time they lit Hanukkah candles in 20 years. Right, low culture can be pure entertainment, but sometimes it moves people in ways that high culture can.
Right.
Because most people are not moved by high culture; they're moved by right low culture.
Right.
Right. This was I haven't read it, but this was Dr. Brill's article, right, in the Orthodox Forum. Right. It has nothing to do with high culture, quote, right.
Mm-hmm.
Highfalutin high culture in the art museum is not often what's changing people's lives for most people.
Right.
Okay. To buy into high culture and low culture is to buy into our society's right assessment of culture, as opposed to if you want to say that the barometer is what is meaningful and what is not, then we should just say that.
Okay. That, because that's really the halacha category that we're speaking about. We're speaking about the Mishnah Berurah, that he says, well, right, source number four of aim, bechlal zeh, etc., etc., etc. Why? Because there's divrei musar and yira and huyad ravaran lichtenstein enriching, right? Musar, yira, and enrichment.
I'm not sure what Wikipedia would be saying the same things about Yosifon as it says about Emmanuel from a literary perspective.
I hear you. I understand. Right.
So I have, I think, a narrow question and a broader question.
Right.
The narrow question is, I'm not sure in terms of your distinction in terms of society, in terms of the Zara and Araya. I'm still almost at a very, very tentative position here. But it seems to me that most Jews live their life without a serious engagement with Christianity. And so the only risk of Jews being seriously engaged with Christianity is if they seriously contemplate Christian art. Pretty much without that, they'll never engage with it.
Right.
Whereas Arayos, to a large extent, Halavai, the exposure to erotic, if we could have kids, would be addicted all day. They would just look at Degas, right, or Picasso, right, and that would be their whole exposure, right? You know, so that, you know, I don't think that, excuse me, I don't think that Degas and Picasso are gateway drugs, to spending your life being confused. Dafka, because we live in an age which is so confused with pornographic images, right, the notion that we need to set tight halachic boundaries on art, which perhaps even in some ways actually can redeem the pornographic, which is about diminishing the physical, turning the physical into nothing. But I don't know that I don't have a particular need to defend this. It's not an issue of mine.
Right.
There we go. I like Mondrian, now maybe I like Rothko, so I don't know if you figured anyway, but I'm not sure about the argument you make. Like, why is that stuff, granted that, we live in the age of Calvin Klein billboards, right?
Right.
The that that you're walking down Manhattan, right, underneath the Calvin Klein billboard, but we don't want you to, but we're terrified of what will happen to your neshama if you end up contemplating Rubin. Seems to me a little bit odd.
Okay, so let's go then to source 5a and 5b. Now I think maybe that will answer that, at least partially. And there's a lot to talk about. It depends on the context. Say especially if you're speaking about yeshiva high school or yeshiva university that's teaching a course on news. I mean, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein said to me straight out, he thinks that why use art courses should not be teaching news. He thinks it's a mistake. There may be a difference if you're giving sanction from the school. If a school which is supposed to be the symbol of Torah is teaching this, then the kids will take it to, then students will take it to, will take it exponentially. Oh, if this is permitted, then it's all permissible.
We'll go there and
figure out how to explain things to kids. Uh-huh. I hear what you're saying. The question is, what messages, what do they hear, and what messages do they not hear? Sometimes the actions are a lot more louder than words. I know it's not a simple issue. It's not a simple issue. Here's another source. We didn't go through any of the Zona stories. the reason why I showed this was because the Gemara does have these stories. So why does it bother? Why is it presenting them? So my basic point of presenting these stories is, why does it do it? Because it's necessary. Because there's a point, and the point would not be accomplished if they would not include the Zona aspects to these stories. Right. So for example, let's just go to 3A, and then I'm going to go to 5A and 5B. 3A, you have this here. This is something for the 9 days. Titus, right? Who's Titus? Titus. Right, we know that. Right? He the Roman emperor, general, conquered Yerushalayim. Zet Titus HaRasha, what did he do when he conquered when he captured the Beis HaMikdash? Shkir v'geir kodimah ma'asa, tafa zona b'yad nechus beis kodesh kodashim. He took a zona in with him to the kodesh kodashim, and he spread out the Sefer Torah, and did the veir on top of the Sefer Torah. Okay? And then he took a sword, and he stabbed the parochet. And a miracle happened, the Gemara says, and blood even came out. And it illustrating the idea of Titus Kaviyochel, God forbid, to his mind, he was killing, I don't even want to say it, we thought he was, what he was killing. Okay. Or that he was successful in killing. Now, here's the question. When the Gemara presents this story, was it necessary to include the Zona aspect of it? Gemara obviously feels yes. There's no way you can get across the power of this story with omitting the Zona. Does that mean if you make a film of if under halachic auspices about Titus, you'd want to include it? I would say no, because there's no way that you can show that. So that goes back to the big difference between the books and that's what you have in film. Okay, all these other examples which you don't have time to go through. Are also all these cases? I believe the Gemara only tells that which is necessary. My wife's insight into this is that even when they tell the stories, say in the Tanakh about Judah and Tamar, they don't go into such graphic detail. They tell that which is necessary. Sometimes there is some graphic detail, like the story of the Zona and Tzitzit. There is some detail of the situation. But the Gemara feels that was necessary. So I think it's important to go through these Gemaras. A lot of these stories you probably know, but it's a good example to know when, at least for pure literature, but not for a film, to see what would be, when is a compromise in tznius, so to speak. Speaking about a zona, certainly a compromise in tznius, but it's done for a purpose, for a musar, and to see how the Gemara does it in certain circumstances, very limited circumstances, a little bit more at length. Let's now go to, I'll include my piece in my talk with this, I don't know if I'm concluding or whatever, but let me just raise this issue of sources 5a and 5b. This is an important Gemara in Pesachim. Gemara says this is an important category for everybody to consider in everything that you're writing. Hanah balol adam bal karcha. We know certain things in the Torah. There's not only nisr achilah, there's also nisr hanah. We cannot benefit from it. What are some examples of that? Basa b'chalav. What are other examples of nisr hanah? Chametz and Pesach. Right. Very good. So what happens if you have hanah that's coming to you against your will? Well, an example I love to give this Gemara is one Chol Moed Pesach. I was working on the Erev in Pelham Parkway. And while I was standing there on Chol Moed Pesach in the middle of the street, where the Erev happened to run by a Dunkin' Donuts. And it was, just at that moment, I guess it was time to make the donuts. And if you remember that old commercial, time to make the donuts. Okay, so it was time to make the donuts. The smell of the Dunkin' Donuts came wafting out onto the street. So what is my halakhic obligation at that point? It's Pesach, and there's smell of delicious chametz that's wafting into my nose. This is what the Gemara calls Hana bol adam bar karcho. So let's take a look and see what the Gemara says about this. Abai says it's mutter and Rava says it's aser. So what does that mean, halakha l'maaser? Mutter or aser? Aser, why? Right, except for Yalkagans, the six cases. Without getting into now, six cases, we follow Abaye, and this is not one of them. Okay. But so, offhand, it would seem to be Aser, and what would I have to do when I'm standing on the streets of Pelham Parkway by the Dunkin' Donuts? What I have to do? I have to immediately get out of there! Just run away from the Dunkin' Donuts. Okay. Now, That would make a good film. What does Baal
Korcho then mean?
What's that?
What does Baal Korcho
mean? That's a major issue. We're going to talk about this. It's addressed in the Tos 5b. All right? This is a very important issue. It's a very critical issue in the Sugya and for what we're speaking about now. So this is the Gemara already sets out the parameters of the Machlokas. If it's Efshir V'komachave, meaning as follows. If there was an alternative, the person did not have to be in that situation where he's going to get hana from this item that's also by hana. The Gemara here is speaking about someone who walks by a base of Arazara, and the time that he walks by and when he walks by the base of Arazara, the smell of the Torah, of the Avarazara, is in the air. So he smells a pleasant smell that's from Avarazara, and he passes by. If he could have walked another block away, it wouldn't have been a big deal, and kamachave. Not only did he have another option, he chooses not to walk down the street where the Avodah Zarah is, and when the smell comes of the Avodah Zarah Ketorah comes wafting in, he goes, "Ah, delicious!" Right? That is clearly right. Kuliyama lo pligi, right? That it is usher, right? So right now. Lo asher v'lo mochavein, right? Or by the Gemara also says lo asher, or if he didn't have a choice but he has kavana, right? If let's say I'm right by the Dunkin' Donuts and I say, here's my chance, oh, I can have hana from I'm here for a religious purpose, now I can have some hana from chametz and Pesach. Oh, okay, donuts, right? I can smell it, right? So that's awesome. Even if it's low efshah, even if I'm there for a legitimate reason, okay, and I didn't really have a viable alternative. Here's, okay, that's nobody, and also, that everybody agrees, awesome. But here's the key thing. Low efshah v'lo kamachavin. If it's impossible otherwise, I'm going to clarify what that means, low efshah. V'lo machavin, that's not his intention, then kul yama lo pligi d'shari. Everyone would agree that it's permissible. Right, keep pligi the efshar below machave. Okay, so let's just come out with this. When is it mutter? When you don't have kavana, and if it's low efshar, if it's efshar already it's a machlokes, but if it's low efshar below machave, even Rava agrees that it's mutter. So this is very important for my situation in Pelham Parkway. So let me ask you this. I'm sitting outside Dunkin' Donuts. Is it situated? Is it Efshar or low Efshar if I stay there? I work on. I don't. Let's say I don't have kavanah. I just go about my business. We're looking at the Erev, and I'm not going donuts, right? What's is that Efshar or low Efshar? What do you think? And you can sneak ahead to 5B.
You need to check the Erev there, or that's what.
Yeah, they need to check the Erev. Or what I could.
Well, do you need to check the Erev?
Well, I can come back next week.
Okay.
After Pesach, I don't need to be there on Kol Moed Pesach.
Like
so it could be Efshar. Okay, or I could go ahead and come back an hour later, then see maybe then there won't be the donut. It won't be the time that they're making the donuts, right? So that's what you think. But look what Tosos say. Look in source 5B. Quote 3, Lo Efshar, the Kulish Shmatz. Whenever it says Lo Efshar, it's Lav Dav, it doesn't mean it's impossible. It means Lo Efshar Kedarko, El B'Torah Gadol. If it would require a Torah Gadol, If I'm able to do a Chol Hamoed Pesach, I'm available, and it would be very difficult for me. We Torah Gadol, it would be difficult for me to go check the air outside of Chol Hamoed. Then we're calling that Lo Efshar, even though it's possible. But if it's only possible with Torah Gadol, then it's considered to be Lo Efshar. Now, why am I bringing this up? Why am I bringing this up in response to Rabbi Clapper's question? So I think that's basically, this is the major question here. You are going to the art museum. You're writing a film. You're watching a film. You're making a film. You're creating literature. And you are, what's your intention? Your intention is to be enriched. You're watching a movie. You want to learn about Mickey Marcus. And then there's a scene on the film that you don't want that film to be there. You don't want that scene to be there. It was up to you, that scene wouldn't be part of the film. But it is part of the film. So is that a situation? Now, lo kamachavin, you don't say, oh, here's my chance. There's no kavanah to do an aver. But is that a situation of lo efshar? In other words, it's artistic integrity. Is historical accuracy, would that be defined as lo efshar, as long as the person is not mechaven? That's what I'm raising. That's just something, you know, it's a point to contemplate. And another point to contemplate is when it comes to our rayos, do we say that, is it worth it putting yourself into an nisayon? I don't have that much of an nisayon to smell donuts on Pesach. But Arayos is, you know, especially in our time, is a lot more challenging. So I would take a little bit more conservative view when it comes to a film. But when it comes to to books, a little bit more open, provided that there is a purpose, and even for films, subtle hints I felt would be, like in this film today, would be acceptable if it's for a purpose. Okay.
I got one more.
What's that?
I got one more question.
Okay, go.
So, you set up the halacha as actually did this year today also, as kind of a claim of the Shulchan Aruch blanket prohibition against Mishnah Berurah's exception for certain kinds of moralistic history. Do you think that if you ask either the Shulchan Aruch or the Mishnah Berurah whether you could restart that plot, they would have said yes?
Okay, let's leave out the Shulchan Aruch is vague enough that you could say yes. So I would say the Shulchan Aruch, I would give it a definite maybe. It can be interpreted as saying that paradise. It doesn't matter. It matters what the book, what the Sefer says. It doesn't matter what he would have said.
Interesting.
Oh, definitely, for sure. How do you? We're not an original intent people. It's what the text says. Well, you think Reb Chaim wouldn't agree with that? Reb Chaim, you think of all Reb Chaim's Kedushim? Reb Aaron Lichtenstein said that. All Reb Chaim's Kedushim are what the Rambam intended? Probably. Maybe not. But it's not what matters. If the text yields that interpretation, it's a legitimate interpretation. So if you can understand this, if you will interpret that, an interpretation of the Shulchan Aruch is that the Moshav Leitzim, it's something that is not meaningful. If it's meaningful, now I've abandoned the high and low culture. Okay. If it's meaningful, it's not Moshe Leitzin. Is it what the Mishnah Berurah means? No, it's not what the Mishnah Berurah would not sanction paradise lost. Okay. But that's Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is representing, in his words, the tradition of Rav Sadia Gaon and the Rambam, which is more open to the Chachma of the Umas HaOlam. And those of us who are following the tradition of the Rambam and Rav Sadia Gaon to be more open to the Chachma of the Umas HaOlam would say that when we come to evaluate the works of the Umas HaOlam, some of the things are, much of the work of the Umas HaOlam is Moshe Leitzin. Some of it is far worse than Moshe Leitzin. And some of it is but some of it is very worthwhile. And that's Chachma that we ignore at our peril, to use Rav Lichtenstein's word. So,
that's dark under it.
So I don't think the Mishnah Berurah would say the paralyzed loss of waste. You know, it's Moshe Leitzin. I don't know if you call it Moshe Leitzin, but he would say something you should not be spending your time doing. Maybe he would consider it Altif Nuhan Lelilim. But that's not the tradition of the Ram and the Rav Sadia Gaon. The Ram didn't consider Aristotle to be Altif Nuhan Lelilim. Mishnah Berurah probably would say it is. But there are Rashi probably would also say Aristotle is Altif Nuhan Lelilim. But they're different traditions. Our community follows the tradition of the Ram and Rav Sadia Gaon. Okay. I hope I didn't succeed in offending everybody in this, but I wanted to thank you, everybody. Thank you very, very much. I will say that this is one of the best shiurim that I've ever, I'm talking about the audience. That I don't know about the quality of my presentation, but the audience has been, in my 25 years of teaching, this was really has been a really wonderful audience and contributory. So.
Okay.
I'm really glad it was worth an 8-hour trip for to come for this deliver this shoot.
I hope you'll read what we produced, and we'll look forward to your article. The journal will be up and coming.
Okay.
It'll come out soon. We should talk about publishing vectors with yourself. All right. Thank you. Do you want to hear the shadow before you go?
Okay.
So here's the visual. The shadow will be something like this. We should all be. At the
earliest you can bring your
shayla, I think. No, absolutely. At the MSA, one of the things that we saw, which I thought was really very cool, was a model of the Pennsylvania Railroad War Memorial, which is a giant statue of an angel with holding a dead soldier. Angel has wings, and the original was much, much bigger than the model we saw. And what attracted me to that, or I thought immediately that was a likely candidate. But I forget who I was standing with and admiring it with. Was Derek?
Excuse me.
And you didn't just it couldn't be there. You can say, what was your expression?
What?
You said something with two.
I don't feel comfortable looking at this.
Because
it was just whatever. When I think of what they were imagining when they said Zimut Adam. That's what I'm hearing.
So it's like as a work of art, which is useful because it's both within the same group we can recognize both its power and why power is not necessarily a good thing. So what I imagined was something like this. You have a teacher who would make it really complicated, is teaching a unit which combines the halachos of Machanet Mitzvah with the story of David Yehonatan. And he wants to bring in a picture of that statue as a way of illustrating Kinat David L'Shaul V'Yehonatan. I said, now what is it like to have somebody who dies in a cause you think is sacred? How do you feel about the fate of somebody who dies in a cause you consider sacred? And furthermore, the teacher's plan.
But isn't like a non-orthodox high school, right?
Yeah, we can call it non-orthodox high school.
Or like it's like a Jewish
place.
Jewish minor orthodox high school. Let's call it minor orthodox high school. Okay, we'll call it not Maudie. Funny that there are no high schools called Tachbar.
Mm-hmm.
So the teacher's plan also is the hope that this will inspire at least some students to produce their project on this unit, their own artistic response to the unit. And you have the question is being asked by the principal of the school, right? Who has to decide? Right? The principal of the school will be somebody who understands both the power and the risk of that particular sculpture and art in general. And the question is: A, can the teacher bring this specific, let's say, large-scale poster to school? And you can write it for the context of that class, even though it's, if you look at the painting, it's got a very nice mukmalah holding a very nice zaradadam. Then we can all look closely and see how the toes are doing. If it has all the toes and all the things like that. And then secondly, what kind of instruction one has to give the students about what constitutes a legitimate artistic response? Right? Can one just give students I want you to do an artistic response to this, or do you have to give them a detailed set of instructions? But I want you to make sure that you do X and Y and Z, and this is right, and this if it's flat, and this is right, and this if it's bullet, and this if it's three dimensional. And so it gives you a chance both to express the question of how one reacts halachically to a specific work of art, which raises specific sets of halakhic questions, and also an opportunity to talk about what you think of this kind of education, right? What kind of regulations halakha ought to impose on artists? Okay, so I will need to sharpen the language specifically, but that's what I envision as being the question that we're responding to. Next week we have three or four shirim left before then, so we should be what we're going to do. We're going to spend a day tracing the meanings of mana elivanzet and the shem pekevot. We seem to get another critique of aesthetic appreciation. So I think we'll spend a day on Avinu Horot and what the parameters of that heter. That heter is, and then we'll spend a day on contemporary tshuvot from the two standard works of artistic tshuvot now, the Madrich Torah Yomani and the Shuvot Omanut, addressing particular types of artistic production, some which will be directly on Reb Jaffer's point about the meaning of edifying and mussar, and what happens, right, and who gets to decide what constitutes a viable act of the Masar. And then if we have time on Friday, I'm not sure yet, on Friday we may do an Agadita to just try and tie it together. So if you have questions about that you think I would ask you not ask Rabbi Jaffer his specific question about that, his specific opinion about that question, but if you have questions about those kinds of issues that you think it might be useful to ask him, so if you'd be willing to field questions for a few minutes on that.
Okay, because I don't want to be driving, getting home so late. So okay, we can always be emails.
Can I give the email address?
Sure.
It's hmjaffer@msn1.
msn.com.
hmjaffer@msn. There's no one. It's Moshe Rosenberg.
Right.
hmjaffer@msn.com. And maybe everyone's really worn out. It was really long.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So we all start thinking about that. And I hope that we'll all look forward to something really valuable. Contribution as well. Thank you very, very much always for coming, for your willingness to be open and honest and to model what it's like to think about real health issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah.
You're turned off now. All right. I
think we could. I think that we're all welcome to take breaks if you so. If you so choose.
All right.
It's been a long day.